From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's sports show, Only a Game. The best thing about rivalries is how they can inspire greatness in teams that might otherwise settle for mediocrity. Consider, as Hall of Fame goalie Ken Dryden does, how Canada has reacted to losing the Stanley Cup to their neighbors to the south every year since 1993.
When you do lose for 22 years, you start to notice. And you know, you start to wonder why.
Well, okay, so maybe that hasn't worked out so well. But sometimes a rivalry brings out the best in both competitors, right? Such as when a chess master challenges a computer.
The computer is not the enemy. It's not the adversary like Kasparov thought. Instead, it's a partner.
And so the stage is set for our rivalry show here on Only a Game. It'll be more fun than listening to a sports call-in show. Not that we're rivals. Stay tuned. This is Tim Rees of the University of Exeter in the UK.
I'm a researcher, a teacher, and I also conduct applied work with athletes to help them perform better.
For a 2012 study, Tim Rees and his colleagues arranged for some of Exeter's most accomplished athletes to throw darts at a board while blindfolded. Then Professor Rees arranged for people to lie to the athletes about how well they'd performed. That is, the athletes were told they'd done badly no matter where their darts had landed.
Yeah, it's quite a downer for them, actually. So they might even have scored 30, so they got three right in the middle in the bullseye. But we would still say to them, you only scored six.
And he did that because...
because they haven't seen how they scored. They turn to us, we show them on a leaderboard, which got another load of false numbers in there, and we say, so you scored six. And that six is right next to a band that says failure.
The leaderboard, featuring fictitious names and numbers, is meant to convince the actual athletes that lots of people have been more accurate with their darts.
And then we start to try to manipulate how they feel about that failure.
What Professor Rees and his colleagues have found is that if dart throwers from the University of Exeter are told by somebody else from the University of Exeter that they have failed and it's out of their control and they won't perform better,
they really take it to heart badly and their motivation seems to drop.
But what if the discouraging words come from a rival? Happily, Exeter has one, the University of Loughborough.
Loughborough traditionally win most or the majority of sporting events in the UK. Exeter are close. So it's a tough rivalry, good-natured, but it's fierce.
So if the Exeter athletes get the same sort of negative feedback from somebody allegedly representing Loughborough, combined with positive reinforcement from their Exeter classmates...
they actively try to resist the negative message. So the most improved performers of all were those who'd initially received the negative feedback from the outgroup, the rival, and then received positive feedback from the in-group.
Professor Rees says there's no reason to believe this phenomenon is limited to darts. The more general and generalizable point of his research is that by conveying negative messages to a rival, a.k.a. trash-talking...
you may end up inadvertently making them play better because they actively try to resist your message and prove you wrong. You run the risk of basically helping to fuel the fire in your opponent that will make them come back and beat you.
Think about that the next time you're tempted to loudly insult the opposing team's hitter who hasn't had a home run in 6 months, or the enemy basketball player on the line and he's lousy at free throws, or even the next time you criticize a coworker right before the weekly staff meeting. You may inadvertently be increasing the chances your rival will succeed. Rivalry is the theme for this week's Only a Game, and our next story takes us to Chile, host of the 2015 Copa America. First held in Argentina in 1916, the Copa America is the oldest international soccer tournament in the world. And the century-old rivalries between the tournament's South American teams go beyond the sport into realms of politics, economics, and culture. As regional rivals Peru and Chile prepare to face off in Monday's semifinals, reporter Elizabeth Troval has our story.
Despite it being Chile's historic square, nearly 100 Peruvian immigrants gather in Santiago's Plaza de Armas to show support for their team playing against Brazil in the Copa America. Red noisemaker in hand, Hoist Solana Cuba takes part in the festivities. Cuba moved here to find a job nearly 2 years ago. He says living in Chile as a Peruvian soccer fan comes at a price.
We're different because if we go out with our jerseys on, they look at us, and they look at us, and they look at us like they're trying to intimidate us, like we're an oddball. But if a Colombian, an Ecuadorian, an African, or from whatever country goes out, for them it's normal. It's us, the Peruvians, that shouldn't be here.
Peru and Chile have a complicated past. Much of the rivalry stems from the War of the Pacific, which started in 1879 and ended with Peru losing mineral-rich southern territories to Chile.
Whenever Peru and Chile play, they call it the Pacific Classic because of the War of the Pacific.
Luis Vargas has lived in Chile for 8 years, though he still continues to follow and support Peruvian soccer. He says, in addition to the war, Peru and Chile also have an ongoing cultural rivalry, a particularly sour one.
Well, to start with Pisco Sour, if it's Chilean or if it's Peruvian.
The famous lime-flavored cocktail is claimed by both countries as their own. Which country invented the cocktail and who makes it better is a common source of disagreement. Peru resident and soccer fan Boris Mercado Mar says the soccer field is where these long-standing rivalries play out.
I think soccer is the ultimate representation of this historic rivalry because there isn't a stronger or more direct confrontation. It's a way to mollify this feeling.
But the War of the Pacific isn't front of mind for everyone in this country. I meet up with Chile fans at the Chilean National Stadium in Santiago for their team's game against Bolivia to ask who they think their biggest rival is. For many, like Debbie Rosenblatt, there's no contest.
Probably Argentina, by far, actually. More than Brazil, because we're neighbors and we have a political history as well. So it's not only about football, it's about everything.
Luckily, God made the Andes to separate us from them.
Celebrated Chilean sports author and journalist Luis O'Neill first began covering soccer by jumping out on the field to interview players at age 10. In his 60s now, O'Neill has yet to see Chile win the Copa América tournament. In fact, the team has never won the title, though they have come close.
There are games that define a generation. For example, the final game of the Copa America 1955 in Santiago.
On that day, Chile would have to beat Argentina for the title. Nearly 20,000 fans were swarming at the stadium entrance, desperate to get in to see the game. At one point, part of the fence broke and fans started pouring into the stadium, causing a stampede. 7 people died.
Chile had the opportunity to be the champion for the first time and beat Argentina. But the logical thing happened and Argentina won 1-0.
And a loss against Argentina packs an extra punch. O'Neill says that Chileans have always looked up to Argentines culturally, even going as far as imitating their accents. He says Argentines have prettier women, are better at soccer, and historically have been a bigger and more powerful country. All that adds up to a lot of envy and resentment.
The whole world finds Argentines unlikable, not just Chileans. The Peruvians aren't big fans of them either. Neither are the Ecuadorians and the Brazilians. Don't even get me started.
Sebastián Pérez Ferrero is an Argentine journalist living in Chile. The rivalry hits close to home for him.
My wife is Chilean and we lived in New York for 12 years. And I remember the first time that we went to see an Argentina-Chile match, and it was a qualifier match. And we went to a restaurant where there were Argentine fans and Chile fans, and we were watching the fans together. And Argentina won that match like 4-0 or 4-1. You know, I was just watching and wasn't saying much. But, like, even so, my wife was like, I don't think she spoke to me the rest of the day.
Like the New York Yankees or the New England Patriots, Argentina seems to be the Latin American team everybody loves to hate.
Perhaps it's the only country in South America that every time they play our European side, the Colombians, the Uruguayans, everybody else might actually be cheering for the Europeans and not for the Argentines. But again, you would have to ask them why. They actually did a poll during the World Cup. I think it was Argentina was picked as the team that most fans wanted to see lose.
Despite their reputation among South American soccer fans, Argentines have just one country on their mind when it comes to rivals.
Within Latin America, without a doubt, it's Brazil. I can't think of another team in Latin America. Chile? Never, ever.
Ramiro Anastasi is an Argentine who moved to Chile a few years ago. He says that the rivalry today with Brazil is purely related to soccer, And with that rivalry comes something else.
There's also admiration. Admiration for what the other team has. It's a rivalry, but a rivalry that also contains a lot of respect.
And Argentina has a lot to respect. Both Brazil and Argentina boast multiple World Cup and Copa America titles, along with arguably two of the best soccer players of all time. Argentina had Maradona, Brazil had Pelé. They've even put this rivalry to music. With the help of his Argentine co-worker, Maria Spriafico, and a video they found on YouTube, Anastasi recalls the lyrics to Argentina's World Cup chant. It begins with, "Brazil, tell me how it feels to be bossed around in your own home," and is set to the tune of Creedence Clearwater Revival's Bad Moon Rising. Even though Argentina never even played Brazil in the World Cup, the song is dedicated to the Brazil rivalry. It concludes, "Maradona is greater than Pelé." For Only a Game, I'm Elizabeth Troval in Santiago.
When we decided to build this week's show around rivals and rivalries, we had a lively discussion of such matchups as Dodgers-Giants, Yankees-Red Sox, Alabama-Auburn, Army-Navy, and, of course, Wilt Chamberlain-Bill Russell. The discussion went on for some time before it occurred simultaneously to each of us that although those rivalries have or had their merits, perhaps nobody would feel the need to hear at length about any of them again. Well, that occurred to almost each of us. I held out for a renewal of the examination of FC Barcelona v. Real Madrid, even though we mentioned it last month, since it would have provided me with another opportunity to celebrate Barcelona's winning everything this year. But I fell silent in a shower of paper cups and jeering. Anyway, we began looking for stories that would expand the appreciation of rivalries because they come in all sorts of packages. Somebody found that study involving the temporary humiliation of blindfolded athletes tossing darts in England. Somebody else wondered how Ken Dryden, the goaltender who helped the Montreal Canadiens win six Stanley Cups from 1971 through 1979, felt about the fact that no team based in Canada had been able to bring the cup home for the past couple of decades. It's in Chicago now. It's been in Southern California. It's been in Florida, not Canada. We were happy to learn that Ken Dryden was sufficiently exercised about that rivalry to return our phone call. So, a little later, you will hear from the only NHL MVP to have graduated from Cornell and served in the Canadian Parliament. We'll also let you in on what we learned about a rivalry between a father and son who both tried to avoid actual work by becoming sports writers, and the ever-popular possibility of the competitor with no heart prevailing when the rivalry features man v. machine. This is either where they cue the spooky music or where I stop. Maybe both. Our rivalry show continues with a story of 22-year-old Notre Dame graduate Pat Connaughton, who was the 41st pick in this week's NBA draft.
Baltimore select Pat Connaughton.
You might be thinking, hey, there's no NBA team in Baltimore, and you'd be right. The Orioles took Connaughton in last year's Major League Baseball draft, and they paid him $428,000 as a signing bonus. Baltimore likes Connaughton's 95-mile-an-hour fastball. On Thursday, Brooklyn took the 6-foot-5-inch guard and then traded him to Portland. The Trailblazers like his shooting and 44-inch vertical leap. Connaughton's personal rivalry is not only between two teams, it's between two sports. I sat down with him this week in Woburn, Massachusetts, at the gym where he's worked out since high school, and he told me that his first sport was baseball.
My mom, when I was a very, very young kid, I'm talking like 3 years old, would have me out in the backyard, and she'd throw baseballs to me. And I wasn't allowed to use the big orange wiffle ball bat. I had to use the little yellow one. And she didn't even throw real wiffle balls. She threw those little plastic golf balls. And it was extremely difficult to do, but she had me out there day in and day out doing it just because she knew I enjoyed doing it, and she wanted to, you know, make it as hard as possible so I could succeed at it when it was easier.
Did she give you a hard time when you missed?
Yeah, she to this day brags about being the person that has struck me out the most.
Wonderful. Did coaches, either at the youth level or at the high school, prep school level, ever pressure you to pick either baseball or basketball, or were you pretty well encouraged to go ahead and play both as long as you wanted to?
So for me, no coach ever did. No coach ever pressured me into it. Now, I've seen it happen. You know, there was a few teams that wanted me to play for them that said, there's no spot for you on this team anymore. I can't tell you the amount of times that after I committed to Notre Dame for two sports that coaches that I played against, not my coaches, but coaches that I played against told me, look, it's not going to work. You're not going to be able to do it.
The Orioles drafted you back in 2014, $428,000 worth. Was there a temptation at that point to say, okay, that's the starting blocks, let's go play some baseball and see what happens?
To be honest, no. For me, I had had the same type of temptation coming out of high school. There were a lot of teams that wanted me to pursue baseball right out of high school and not go to college, upwards of millions of dollars to not do it. But the way I looked at it is, at some point, I'm going to have to succeed in this sport in order to, you know, make it my living. So if they're offering me this money now, and I work as hard as I can at it while I'm in college, while I'm getting a degree, while I'm rounding out myself as a human being overall, you know, hopefully it'll be there afterwards. Hopefully I'll be able to make the most of it, you know, as time goes on and as I get to the right point in my life where I can focus on sports and solely sports.
Was there ever a time, though, let's not talk about pressure that you might have gotten from other people. Was there ever a time where you were playing basketball or playing baseball where you thought, damn, this basketball is really getting in the way of my playing baseball, or the other way around?
You can't really think like that if you want to pursue both. Being a pitcher in baseball, you know, you can't throw every day. Your arm will fall off. You'll get Tommy John seven times. You need to give your arm some rest, and the athleticism that you need in basketball, you know, helps you do that.
Tell me a little bit about what you're doing this summer. I know it's basketball focused, but do you still get out in the backyard and throw to your mother?
She still tries to strike me out, actually. But
which is easy because you're a pitcher.
Exactly.
You're
not supposed to.
Exactly, unless you're in the National League. You know, for me, I'll focus on basketball. I'll put 100% at it. But being a basketball player in the NBA, you know, your legs need rest from day to day. And, you know, I always used pitching as an off day as I grew up during basketball season just to keep my arm in shape. So when you're playing a sport or sports, in my case, that you love, you always find a way to make sure that you're at least preparing yourself for whatever may come down the road.
All right, let's talk about some of the other athletes who have had opportunities in more than one sport, and none of their names will surprise you. Dave Winfield, drafted by the NBA, the ABA, NFL, Major League Baseball. Danny Ainge, played for the Blue Jays, had an NBA career. Bo Jackson, Deion Sanders. Do you sort of think of yourself in those terms, kind of following in the footsteps of any of them?
I think for me, one thing that I've learned is that every two-sport athlete has his own path. Some of them are different sports. Some of them are football and baseball. You know, some of them did it different ways. Danny Ainge played, you know, baseball while he was in college and then professionally and then went to basketball afterwards. So, you know, they're all done a little bit differently. I owe it to myself not to give up on one because there's a lot of money in the other. Money shouldn't be a factor in, you know, deciding what you want to do for your entire life. And to be quite honest, it serves as a platform to, you know, be a role model to the kids that you don't have to, you know, specialize at such a young age like so many people are trying to get kids to do nowadays.
And I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. It's been a pleasure and good luck going forward with whichever sport you end up majoring in.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to the recently crowned NHL champion Chicago Blackhawks, the Stanley Cup has recently taken a helicopter tour of the Windy City with winger Marian Hossa. It was on stage with Mumford & Sons when they played Montrose Beach. Over the past 22 years, nobody from a team based in Canada has had that sort of fun with the Stanley Cup. Hockey Hall of Famer Ken Dryden became an attorney and served in the Canadian Parliament after helping the Montreal Canadiens win half a dozen cups in the 1970s. In a recent op-ed for the Wall Street Journal, he wrote about the drought. Ken Dryden, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
Obviously, fans in any city root for the team in that city. Edmonton fans root for Edmonton, Toronto fans root for Toronto, and so on. But after 22 years with the Cup not coming home to Canada, I wonder if all Canadian fans would root for any Canadian team that would have a shot.
Well, that's a very good question. And I think that there's kind of an assumption that's what would happen. But I think that, you know, that among real fans, would a Canadiens fan hope for the Leafs if they were in the Stanley Cup final? I don't think so. I think, in fact, in many ways, it would almost be the last team you would hope for. I'm sure it would be the same in Calgary and Edmonton. But I think that when you do lose for 22 years, you start to notice and you know, you start to wonder why. And so maybe there might be a little bit of a weakness for that great rival that might make it to the finals.
Maybe Canadians can take some solace from their Olympic success. The men's team has won two straight gold medals. The U.S. has not recently been much of a force. Does Canada still see the U.S. as a rival at that level, the men's teams?
I'm more speaking for myself in this, and I don't know about the majority of Canadians. I want the final to be Canada against Russia. That, I think, is the deepest, most profound rivalry that exists in hockey. Now, the U.S. is doing better than Russia is in most of the, you know, the international competitions now. It still feels a bit strange to me. Winning against Russia is an immense triumph, and losing is an extreme disappointment. Winning against the U.S. feels like less of an extreme triumph, and losing feels more like an embarrassment. And it's not, I mean, the U.S. is getting really good, but that's what it feels like. And I think it goes into the kind of, you know, larger relationship that Canada has, you know, with the U.S., that we often think of ourselves as sort of a lesser version of what it is you are, as opposed to an important version of what we are.
Maybe the best rivalry between the two countries is in women's hockey. Canada leads in world championships 10-6 and in Olympic gold medals 4-1. But as women's hockey gets better around the world, I wonder, will that rivalry endure?
I think it will. It is a great rivalry. I mean, every year they not only make the, you know, the finals against each other, but it's absolutely a toss-up as to who's going to win.
In the context of this week's theme, I found myself wondering if the CFL and the NFL are rivals in any significant sense. And all I could come up with was the fact that a few players have left the CFL to find success in the NFL,
right?
Warren Moon and Doug Flutie, for example.
Yeah.
And that probably irked their supporters in Canada. Am I missing something?
There's such a difference in the level of the two that when somebody like Warren Moon becomes a star in the U.S., instead of it irking Canadians, I think it's a point of pride. And it's actually the same in terms of baseball and basketball. When Steve Nash was a great star for so many years and won the MVP, that was a point of terrific pride for Canadians. Andrew Wiggins, the new rookie of the year.
Plus Neil Young.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, the singers. I mean, Joni Mitchell, Neil Young, I mean, on and on were writers, Margaret Atwood, Alice Munro. When I was at Cornell, I mean, I would interrupt every conversation to tell them, you know, that person was a Canadian. And, I mean, that's what we do. The happy part of it is that there are just more and more and more names, and whether it's Arcade Fire or it's endless now, and that's wonderful.
Ken Dryden was an impossibly successful goaltender at Cornell and for the Montreal Canadiens, with whom he won the Stanley Cup 6 times. I wonder, after you'd won it 5 times, did you even bother to take the cup back to your hometown again, or was everybody tired of seeing it?
Well, that tradition didn't start until the mid-1990s.
Ah.
So I never had my day with the cup. But a couple of years ago, I persuaded the Hockey Hall of Fame to allow me a day with the cup. So in 2012, I had the cup at our old house that we grew up in, where our parents had paved our backyard so all of the neighborhood ball hockey games could take place there. We had one final game there in our backyard with all of the original players, their kids, their grandkids, with the cup, with one of the original nets, and the other net was a net from the last game of the Montreal Forum, and we had the anthem singer of the Toronto Maple Leafs singing the anthem.
I wish I'd been there.
Boy, it was great.
Ken Dryden, thank you very much for speaking with me. It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks, Bill. I've enjoyed it.
According to the incredibly stratified rankings in the world of chess, experts should never win against international masters. International masters should almost never win against grandmasters. And computers were never supposed to win against the best player in the world. At least that's how it was until 1997, when IBM's Deep Blue beat then world champion Garry Kasparov in six games. But that match was far from the end of the rivalry between humans and chess-playing computers. Chess master Dana McKenzie tells us that story in his own words.
You know, I remember when the first chess calculators came out in the late 1970s, and they were absolutely pathetic. Beginning humans make mistakes, but somehow the computer mistakes were different. You know, they were just really awful. But, you know, computers and calculators got better and better. Nowadays, computers are so strong that even a guy like Magnus Carlsen, the world champion, would have no hope against a computer. Once computers got past the point of being laughingstocks and started becoming serious masters, then there was this whole debate, you know, can a computer ever beat a human? The human world champion, Garry Kasparov, said, no, it'll never happen because humans have this element of creativity in their play and a computer can never be creative. You know, there's been this whole mythology of the grandmaster. They're like the Picassos, the Van Goghs of chess. And now in retrospect, we can see that, yes, computers can play these sorts of moves. They look at every possible move and eventually at some point, that brute force calculation strength starts turning into something that looks like human creativity. So back in the early 2000s, I got one of the top computer programs. It was called Fritz. There's this one particular opening that I got interested in where White sacrifices a queen on the sixth move of the game. Queen sacrifices are the pinnacle in chess. They're the most spectacular move possible, and they're considered the most beautiful move possible. What I was doing by looking at this queen sacrifice variation was really pursuing the most beautiful possible opening line I could and trying to work out its beauty. And the faith, my faith that the move worked, was a faith in beauty itself. The compensation I get for sacrificing the queen is this incredible sense of harmony and communication between my pieces, and that goes and goes and goes, and it lasts for 20 moves or 30 moves, even though a computer can calculate 5-10 moves ahead, can calculate farther than any human. It goes way beyond the computer's threshold, and every game would be different, and yet every game also was reinforcing the belief in me that, yes, this opening works. The computer doesn't feel fear, and that is what leads it to take my queen every time. So for 2 years, I had not run into any human opponent who had the courage to actually take my queen. In this tournament in 2006 in Reno, in the last round, I played against an international master named David Preuss. He knows that he should not lose to me, and so he has this psychology that this crazy opening that I'm playing can't possibly be sound. Even if it looks scary, he's an international master, and he will show me where my thinking is wrong. And so this was the perfect person for me to play the sacrifice against. I was, in effect, the grandmaster. He didn't stand a chance against me. He kept posing little tricks and traps to me. He did not go down easily, but, you know, I did not want to screw up at that point, you know, because I knew this was my masterpiece. What happened after was truly wonderful. At chess tournaments, there's something called a skittles room to go over the game with your opponent, you know, to prove to him that you could have checkmated him, you know, five moves before he checkmated you. So an hour after the game, I go into the Skittles room and I see this huge group of people and they're going over my game. Like, I couldn't believe it. These are like all the grandmasters at the tournament and the international masters. And Dave Proust was there and, you know, everybody's trying to prove to him what an idiot he was. But, you know, he's saying, no, what would you do? You know, what did I do wrong? I still can't prove that this opening I played is sound. You can't prove it's unsound, and the computer can contribute to the conversation, but it doesn't resolve it either. The computer is not the enemy. It's not the adversary like Kasparov thought. Instead, it's a partner. Combining the computer with the humans, you can actually create something greater than either one of them can do on their own.
Chess master Dana McKenzie is still trying to use his queen sacrifice whenever it's appropriate. This segment was produced by Only a Game's Karen Given. If you'd like to look us up on your computer, whether or not it plays chess, follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. Coming up on Only a Game, you want a rivalry? How about the aquatic equivalent of the cattlemen versus the sheepherders? But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Cows and sheep in the pool?
Just stay tuned. It's going to be brilliant. We will pick up on our rivalry theme in just a few minutes, but I want to start with Thursday's NBA draft. Kentucky center Karl-Anthony Towns was not a surprise first pick when Minnesota chose him. Did anything in the draft surprise you?
The chalk held pretty much. I'll tell you what really alarmed me, Bill. I can't tell you how many players in that draft had fathers who I covered when they played college basketball. It's really distressing.
I was kind of hoping you'd say you were at least a little surprised by some of the outfits that the drafted players were wearing. I mean, the sparkly shoes especially. And
well, Kelly Oubre was wearing footwear from Mars. I don't know where he picked those up. We've come a long way, though, from when they all used to dress like extras from Warren Beatty's movie Bugsy.
The Golden State Warriors won the championship with a so-called small ball lineup, but two of the top three picks in this draft were big men. Is this a return to the land of the Giants in the NBA, or are Towns and Philadelphia pick Jahlil Okafor just better than anybody else?
That's the case. If you're a basketball coach, you can't let somebody like Karl-Anthony Towns get by, and Okafor is not far behind him. These were just the best two players in the draft.
The New York Knicks fans love to boo at drafts especially, Charlie, and this year the object of their disapproval was a Latvian named Kristaps Porzingis, taken by New York at number 4. Porzingis said later they don't want a European on their team. I think maybe he just hasn't paid enough attention to New York Knicks fans in the past, right?
Yeah, that's the point. They just don't want anybody on their team until they're on their team, and then they really like them.
Pete Rose, banned from baseball back in 1989 for gambling when he was a manager, applied again for reinstatement this year, Charlie. I guess he figured new commissioner, what the heck. And I guess he didn't figure on the unearthing of a notebook belonging to one of Rose's former associates in which, oops.
Yeah, somebody has been holding this particular trump card for quite some time before leaking it. It showed that he was gambling on baseball while he was playing, which is, of course, the absolute death sentence.
Yeah.
So I think this was a secret thing somebody kept in a drawer until they really needed it.
One Only a Game listener has suggested the following solution. Allow Rose into the Hall of Fame because his play on the field warrants it, but wait until after he dies so that nobody has to listen to his acceptance speech. What do you think?
Do you not want to hear his acceptance speech? I'm dying to hear his acceptance speech.
Charlie, you might be interested to know that when FIFA President Sepp Blatter announced back on June the 2nd, and I quote, "I have decided to lay down my mandate at an extraordinary elective Congress," he was not, in fact, resigning. What do you suppose he was doing?
He was laying down his mandate, Bill. It's right there on the table. You can go look at it.
And nobody picked it up, so he doesn't have to leave.
That's right. People just sort of left it there. So, first of all, Bill, that question is entirely premised on Sepp Blatter having some form of integrity, which we all know he doesn't have.
Apparently, at issue is whether a so-called convincing candidate has emerged to replace Sepp Blatter. Maybe you and I could help by brainstorming some names that would do a better job than Mr. Blatter has done. M. Mouse, for example?
Well, Pablo Escobar is dead. So, you know, I'm a little bit stumped at this point.
This is our rivalry show, so let us talk about rivalries. Have you a favorite among the many team rivalries that you've witnessed over the years?
you know, I think certainly the greatest individual rivalry I ever saw was Martina Navratilova and Chris Evert, because they both changed not only their physical appearance but their approach to the game to keep up with the other one. Among individual rivalries, I think that's certainly it. Among team sports, certainly the Celtics and the Lakers in the 1980s, and the, for that matter, the Celtics and the Lakers in the 1960s, I think are the ones that stay in my head.
I wonder how far back it's safe to go in this sort of discussion with our audience. If I were to say Mays versus Mantle versus Snyder, would everybody be looking at their radios and asking, who?
No, everybody will be turning to the classic rock station to listen to Willie Mickey and the Duke. I think, and oddly enough, in that one, I think most people remember Willie Mays and most people remember Mickey Mantle, but I think most people would be really stumped as to who this Duke character was. A lot of rivalry is the way individuals feel about their teams. I mean, you can declare a rivalry with practically anybody. You could, I mean, the Red Sox and the Tampa Bay Rays had a great rivalry for a few years. They kept throwing baseballs at each other's heads. That's sort of quieted down now, but you can have rivalries that don't stand the test of time, too.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
There's also Greece and Troy, which we didn't get into.
Yeah, it was a good one.
That was a really good one, except they only played one away game.
The rivalry between a father and son can be particularly challenging, especially when a father and son share the same job. Also the same name, and the son had it first. Author and journalist Mark Cram Jr. has edited Great Men Die Twice, an anthology of the writing of his father, Mark Cram, best known for his time at Sports Illustrated in the 1960s and 70s. Mark Cram Jr., welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. It's great to be here.
How did your father come to share your name?
Well, it's a long story. He had something of an identity crisis as a young man growing up in East Baltimore. He was called Sonny. He was called Otts. Even when he played in minor league baseball, he sort of started calling himself Randy because he thought it made him run faster. He's got a point because, you know, you see an awful lot of lead-footed Georges out there and not too many lead-footed Randys. When I was born, my mom named me Mark because she liked the name Mark. And Dad saw me lying there in the crib, and instead of taking my rattle, he took my name. So basically, it caused a great collision between us over the years.
Before we go any further, I want to establish for our listeners what a great and worthy idea it was to collect the best of your father's writing. Would you please read for us the end of the February 1975 Sports Illustrated story titled The One-Minute Angels? It closes with the account of the death of a boxing trainer named Charlie Goldman.
I'll be glad to. At the end of his life at 85, Charlie lived alone in one room on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. The fixtures of his work were all over the room, Q-tips, beat-up satchels, old chewed-up mouthpieces with a thin coat of dust. He used to sit there, his gnarled little hands clasped, and speak of Rocky Marciano. I was the trainer of Rocky Marciano, he liked to say. He was not being boastful. He just wanted to make sure it was part of the record, for that was all he had left. And then one day they found him in his room, dead and wearing an old robe of Rocky's. Greater love hath no trainer.
A lot of people know your father wrote brilliantly about some of the fights in which Muhammad Ali was involved, but is it fair to say that your father was drawn to obscure figures as well?
Yeah, he was. He liked to think he was always poking in corners, the dark corners of sports, looking for characters. You're there by yourself, and all your courage and your manhood is exposed for all to see. And it really resonated deeply with him. Dad was a kind of a lonely guy. He was inward-looking most of his life.
Your dad had been one of the stars at Sports Illustrated for some time. What were the circumstances that led to his leaving the magazine?
He had been drinking heavily, and he had financial difficulties. His marriage to my mother had fallen apart. He got involved with Don King, the boxing promoter. King had wanted to become involved in Hollywood. He wanted to produce films. And Dad had taken some money from King to do a treatment on battling Siki, the old fighter. Dad was of the belief that it wouldn't affect how he wrote about King in the magazine, and in fact, he was very tough on King in the magazine throughout the years. But, you know, that's an ethical breach. You can't be involved in a business relationship with somebody you're writing about.
In a recent piece for the New York Times, you write, even under ordinary circumstances, lugging around the same name as your father is problematic. Tell us about some of the problems.
Well, it's like if Dustin Hoffman had a son and named him Dustin Hoffman. You know, he had a big name at a time when Sports Illustrated was, you know, the biggest publication in the country. When he took my name, he solved his own identity crisis. Mine was only beginning. You know, it was like I fooled around with all sorts of variations that put some distance between us. My middle initial, G, Mark G. Cram. I used M. G. Cram. Dad even suggested that I assume some Austrian nobility and put a von in there, Mark von Cram. I think he was loaded that night when he said that. But I actually seriously considered it at one point. I mean, I was really, my career was just beginning. And yet I was carrying around this name that had a bit of tarnish on it.
Elsewhere in that New York Times piece, you write, and again I'm quoting, I was by turns proud of what he had accomplished and furious at how he had squandered it.
Yes.
Was your father aware of that ambivalence?
I'm sure he was. You know, I spoke candidly with him over the years. He was sensitive, I think, to the situation I was in, but we didn't really talk about it too much. And we didn't talk about my writing either. In fact, I had no sense that he had even read any of my work. I mean, I could have been a butcher or sold shoes. I mean, we just didn't talk about my writing. And then the interesting thing is, though, that after he died, I came into possession of all his boxes of papers and things. At the bottom of one, there was about 60 or 70 pieces that I'd written, all
wow.
In a stack, in a folder. And, you know, I get chills even thinking of it. So he was paying attention. But, you know, he did me a great service by not getting too involved in my work. He understood that you sort of have to find your own way in writing, in the creative arts.
Mark Cram Jr. is the author of Like Any Normal Day, and he has edited Great Men Die Twice, the selected works of Mark Cram, who is, of course, his father. You can find an excerpt from the latter book at onlyagame.org. Mark, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate it.
Stand-up paddleboarding is billed as the world's fastest-growing water sport, but there's at least one group of wave enthusiasts not having any of that, surfers. One accomplished surfer recently wrote in The Telegraph, quote, to take to the water on a stand-up paddleboard is to cross to the dark side, like a rower switching to kayaking. What's behind this growing rivalry? For more on that, here's KCRW's Saul Gonzalez.
I'm a Southern Californian who doesn't spend a lot of time at the beach. And what I know about surfing culture, I've mostly gleaned from that 1991 Keanu Reeves minor classic, Point Break.
You're trying to tell me the FBI is going to pay me to learn to surf?
But even I've noticed the growing number of stand-up paddleboarders out in the water.
It's kind of like bicycling, you know, it's pervasive, it's everywhere. It's just sort of a access to the water, and anywhere there's water, there's going to be a paddleboard and a paddleboarder.
Tim Sanford is a paddleboarding instructor. He says a lot of people are coming to the sport because it's a way for mere mortals to feel like they're kind of walking on water.
The idea of gliding is really what stand-up paddleboarding is all about. Catching the glide or kind of initiating that glide by creating your own momentum has got this addictive feeling to it. So you kind of end up in this very kind of blissful state.
But it hasn't been all bliss for stand-up paddleboarders. As more of them take to the water, they're angering those traditional top dogs of the beach, surfers, like Rain Lahell, who I meet on the sand one early Saturday morning in Malibu.
As a surfer, what do you think of stand-up paddleboarders?
If they're in the lineup, they me off because they really get in the way and can kill you if they drop in on you. Several times I've been on a wave and a paddleboarder's tried to go for it and it's almost took my head off, so they can me off when I'm in the lineup.
Such anger relates to size. And yes, it does matter in the water. Stand-up paddleboards, also called SUPs, are enormous, up to 14 feet long. In fact, they're so big, the Coast Guard classifies paddleboards as vessels. Surfers say that size makes the SUPs a hazard in surf zones, especially if a paddleboarder is inexperienced.
It's just a matter of time until they ban SUPs.
You think that's really the case? Is that where
it's just waiting for the first monster injury.
That's Jefferson Wagner, who goes by the surf name Zuma J.
They'll say, this is the same size as a kayak. It shouldn't be out there. It's another safety hazard.
Zuma J is a former mayor of Malibu and owns the oldest surfboard shop in town. And Zuma J really, really doesn't like stand-up paddleboarders at traditional surfing beaches. Beyond safety issues, he says paddleboarders, and you hear this a lot from hardcore surfers, just defend his surfing aesthetic and that quasi-mystical surfer idea of being one with the ocean.
They themselves may feel that that's the experience they're achieving of being one with the wave. However, I don't feel that way, and that's just my opinion. It's not surfing. Even though they may think it is, they've got a paddle. They've got an extra appendage. I'm not running out there in the water with an extra appendage. It's just myself and my board.
But a lot of paddleboarders don't have nice things to say about surfers.
Surfers, they're very chauvinist. I used to be one of them. Very selfish people.
Surfers are very selfish people.
Yes, exactly.
That surfer-turned-stand-up paddleboarder Al Duca. He says surfers are just wrong if they think paddleboarding is less challenging or takes less skill than what he's doing out on the water.
More intense.
It's more intense for you?
Yes. Really? Well, because you have to stand up. As a surfer, you just wait till the wave comes. Here, you have to be alert. You cannot drift off. You have to be on that moment.
With more than a million Americans now paddleboarding, and those numbers growing, the culture clash between paddleboarders and surfers shows no sign of ending anytime soon. Blame the competition to catch that perfect wave, says paddleboard instructor Tim Sanford.
You got to have a strong ego to want to take on a wave and think you can conquer it. So people have strong egos, and they work hard, and it's a physical environment, and it's dangerous, and, you know, people's tempers get, you know, flare up. And there's jerks everywhere, and there's paddleboard jerks, and there's surfer jerks, and, you know, it's a high-intensity moment, so things can get out of hand pretty quickly.
But there are some in each community who are ready to call a truce. J.P. Bislick is a surfer.
Man, everybody should just respect each other in the ocean, man. I mean, it's everybody's, you know? I'm just in there to have fun, you know? So should everybody else. Just have fun and go with it.
For Only a Game, I'm Saul Gonzalez.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. We had help this week from Zoe Sobel, Steve Brown, Jack Lepiarz, Peter Lydodes, John Parati, Paul Vikas, and J.D. Hilliard at KUSP in Santa Cruz, California. Our intern is Joe Jacobs, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Are you listening to the Only a Game podcast yet? Sign up at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you prefer to access podcasts. Our final word this week comes from Deep Blue, the first computer to beat a reigning world champion chess player. Oh, yeah, that's pretty good. You're smart, huh? You think you could do my job?
I'm Bill Littlefield. I'll be back next week with more sports and PR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.
Yikes.